morning and welcome to the Wednesday, April 14th edition of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Natural Resources Subcommittee. Colleagues, I apologize for our late start this morning, but we've been pulled into hallway conversations and confabs on the salmon issue, and I expect that that will get slightly more intense as we move forward towards pulling draft and forward into the consideration of the committee. We left off yesterday on public comments for House Bill 5019. We took some good public testimony. We probably will have a request for additional people to come forward, and as that happens, we'll reopen the public hearing on HB 5019. But in the meantime, let's get back to Mary Wall, the Division Administrator for Waste Management and Cleanup Division, who is involved in the agency program presentation. Mary?
Good morning. Sorry for our late beginning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Wall, Administrator for Waste Management and Cleanup at the ETO. There were a couple questions that I wanted to go back to and answer real quickly, and then I'll go into the presentation where I left off. One of the questions was, what percentage of underground storage tanks that leak, and that's in excess of 75% of those that we get to.
Ms. Wall?
Yes.
We're in Section 4, what page?
We are in Section 4, and it was slide number 31 and page 60.
Thank you.
One other question was, and it came up during the discussion of the new CARISA, and the question was whether plans exist that list locals who can respond, and if that's what we do when there's a response plan that people have to put together, they can enlist it, assistance or a subcontract with whomever they choose. We try to make sure that they know about locals and try to give the locals a forum to talk to some of the responsible parties, and we've done that in several instances. The fact is that in the parts of the state where there aren't those geographic response plans, then locals would not necessarily be known to people who are responding. So then going on with the presentation, we had talked about DEQ's role when there are threats and impacts to the environment. I talked about cleanup, which is when prevention and safe management don't work. I'm now ready to talk about prevention, and that's where we'll start on page 15. And prevention, as I mentioned earlier, is trying to prevent the generation of waste or spills in the first place. This is the slide that I mentioned a couple times earlier. The part of the state outlined in red is where we do have geographic response plans for spills when they happen. The rest of the state doesn't have to have them at all. And the rest of the state's waterways are not covered by these geographic response plans. So we wouldn't know what equipment's needed. In Tuspe, one of the things we did was know which beaches to, which areas to boom, which beaches to try to collect the oil on. We wouldn't have it in the rest of the state. The other thing that's not in place is some of the preparedness and training, and we talked about that a little bit. So the state agencies don't do a lot of drills and training together. The other thing that's not there because we don't do that kind of training is that a lot of spills are human error. They result from human error. And those are the things that you can get at in training. And one of the most frequent ones actually on the Columbia River is when people are fueling the ships and it overfills. And those kinds of things don't make a horrific kind of spill, but they make a lot of other spills. Yeah. Moving on then on another kind of prevention, this is a hazardous waste or toxic use reduction. These don't look like so much, but these are the kind of everyday prevention efforts and technical assistance efforts that make a huge difference. In Oregon, there's a toxic use reduction requirement, so firms of a certain size that use certain chemicals need to go through their systems basically and try to plan for or analyze what kind of hazardous substances they're using and find ways to reduce the use if they can. Just the requirement to plan and analyze is all it takes in a lot of cases for people to make fairly major changes. This one, they streamlined a production line that separated the lubricating oils from the metal waste, and then they could return the oil for reuse. looks like no big deal. It saves them about $130,000, which is a side benefit, but it actually makes it a lot easier to work with businesses if you can also show them how it's going to be of some use to them.
Question. In the hazardous waste reduction or toxic use reduction program, I've heard anecdotally from a couple of companies that they have gotten into this process fairly intensively. Remanufacturing, re-smeltering, recapturing, reprocessing from the waste stream and then re-injecting those materials into the manufacturing process saves them money, keeps them underneath their thresholds by significant amounts in terms of discharge. I don't know if it saves them money, but it certainly is a commitment to good stewardship and citizenship in the community. And as a result of that, we've had discussions and feedback from them about proposals to reduce their permit output and to require them to be permitted under a higher standard. For instance, moving from a discharge permit to a reprocessing permit, the same one that we've put in Arlington, for instance, for the sorting of hazardous materials, or the same one that we would require of a private company that offers recycling services to the general public on a fee basis. And in both those cases, it seems to me that we're penalizing good citizenship. And I want to know from you, what's the logic behind asking people to become good environmental stewards and seeing them make significant improvements and then turning around and asking them to become licensed under a far higher standard or reducing their permit parameters, which may at some point in the very near future be an asset to that company in terms of pollution tax credits or pollution credits. Why are we offering disincentives for good stewardship? What's up with that?
Mr. Chair, I have to admit I don't know of any, I'll have to find out from you the specifics, because I know of instances where it's gone the other way, where the technical assistance has worked with somebody and now they no longer need, for instance, a water quality permit. I don't know of one where we went the other way, so I can't tell you what the logic is to go the other way, because what we're generally doing, and that's one of the incentives we do offer to people, is if you stop using, for instance, a one solvent and switch to a water-based solvent, you can end up not needing a permit anymore, or you can drop from being a large quantity generator, which has a different layer of regulation, to a small quantity generator, or even a conditionally exempt is the term. But so I have lots of instances of that. This one, I didn't realize that we had one of those, and I'll have to figure it out what it is.
Okay. Well, let me give you a little bit more to do your sleuthing work with, and the bottom line for me is that I've been told that if a company engages in recapture of heavy metals, for instance, and reprocesses those, that they're in the recycling business. Now, that could be a battery manufacturer. It could be a high-tech manufacturer of circuit boards. It could be, any number of companies that have done reprocessing as a focal point for their reduction of hazardous waste and toxic output. And as a result of that, they've been talked to by their DEQ permit managers about the necessity to permit them as if they were a recycler of hazardous or toxic material, meaning that there would be rather strict controls at every single stage of the recapturing and recycling process. And tiers of the new additional regulations that would apply to a reprocessor or recycler that offers those services to the general public. And then this application would be made to a company, not an application for a permit, but an application of these standards, to a company that does no external processing. It's all an internal process. And it's been generated, or the reprocessing has been driven by the desire to lower their outputs within the terms of existing permits. And if there is a triggering mechanism that puts people at risk of going to that higher standard, I think that works as a disincentive. I just want to make sure that's not getting out there, and if it is, we need to know why.
Mr. Chair, I'll definitely talk to the hazardous waste managers and see if they can find out what it is. I wouldn't tell you that the hazardous waste regulations, which are federal regulations, don't have some twists in them that make it, at least when you first walk into them, make little or no sense. There's a good reason behind most of those, but this one, I just have to look into it. I don't know the answer. And why it would go up instead of down,
right.
Well, seemingly they're doing the right thing and they're getting the wrong answer, if you will.
Well, and I think there is a potential for that, because what they're actually doing is engaging new processes in order to reduce the waste stream. And those new processes are regulated processes.
Right.
But we just have to be careful about providing a threshold that makes the diminishing returns factor so big that people just throw up their hands and say it's better to leave the stuff in the waste stream than it is to try and reduce it with reprocessing.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, if I may, I'm Lang Marsh, Director of DBQ. This is one of the reasons why we started the Green Permits program that I described earlier, was to try to provide an avenue to uncover regulatory issues, even if they're federally driven, that don't make sense. And the states have negotiated a regulatory innovation agreement with EPA, which allows us, under certain circumstances, to ask them for, it's not quite the full Oregon option waiver kind of approach in the social services, because there are statutes and regulations involved, but to give as much flex on some of these things as we can. So certainly the direction we want to go in is lining up the incentives in the right way so that people do feel encouraged to go even beyond their regulatory requirements, where that makes sense to them environmentally and it's a cost-effective thing to do. So the policy direction is certainly in the line that you're suggesting, and it's the question of uncovering these things and where we can change them at the state level and where we can't, trying to put some pressure on the federal government to make it make sense.
Well, I would like to engage in this discussion, because the industry leaders are the ones that pull people
in the direction that we want them to go, and for providing some sort of a trap door that they fall into, that we need to have that looked at, either at the federal or state level. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, especially with, if I could just add on one other thing, especially with small businesses, we really look for the incentives, either that they can save money at it, or that they can use less process, or that those things we have to have, especially with the small businesses. And we've spent a lot of years with the larger businesses. We're working with an awful lot of small businesses now, so what you're talking about makes a lot of sense. And it's what, I mean, unless the incentives are lined up, we lose a lot of these people. My next slide is one more of the prevention items. This one, ignore all of the boxes. There's no need to look at all of the little boxes. This one is just intended to show you a before and after, before technical assistance and after technical assistance. We worked with this company, and on the top are the number of steps that they had before we worked with them, and the bottom is after. And for instance, in this one, they went from 8 solvent washings to 3, which again doesn't sound like a huge thing, but not using those solvents makes a big difference. Using them fewer times means less chance of spill and that sort of thing. They also went to a less toxic substance in that wash. So they cut the amount and they cut the toxicity as well in this one. One more of the preventing environmental problems, and this is working with a small business. This is a trucking firm. Before the visit, they were using solvents to wash the diesel engine. After the visit, they went beyond, again, and this is important, they went beyond what they absolutely needed to do to reduce leaks to the environment. And in this one, it's an example of where they did no longer need to have the permit, because they went from 1,500 pounds per month generated to 75 pounds. So this is an example of where this actually works, and you can put the incentives in place. This technical assistance was a visit that was an attempt to go to all of the automotive repairs, or as many as we could get to all at once. So.
Okay.
Okay, Mitchell.
I'm curious how they did that.
How do they clean their engines if they don't use solvents?
Because they use solvents, they use water-based solvents now instead of the solvents they were using before, and what small amount of non-water-based solvents they still use, they have in what's called a closed loop, so it never gets out. So they just pipe it right back in, and so it can't get out. So those kinds of things with closed loop and switching from one kind of solvent to a water-based solvent, they ended up not needing a permit. So I talked about cleanup, which is the bottom of the hierarchy, and what happens when prevention or good management don't work and there are leaks. I talked about prevention in the first place, which is the top of the hierarchy. In the middle is safe management, and this means that you do a good job of managing and disposing of waste that can't be prevented. It's ongoing good management of waste in facilities. It's protective storage of them and good disposal. It's good management at the landfill. There are a couple kinds of companies that we deal with on this. One is a company that hazardous waste is a natural byproduct of what they're doing. It's part of the process. There are also companies whose business is hazardous waste. So those fall into this. And others that use hazardous substances in their process but don't have waste at the end. This is an example of safe management from tank leaks. And this is an example of the kind of things that have gone on across the state where new upgraded tanks are in place, so groundwater won't be damaged, and so we have a good system across the state to store petroleum. You could either upgrade or you could put in new tanks. The upgrades will last for probably less time than the new ones. They're slightly less effective, but there are good upgrades that have happened across the state, and those are acceptable. Pre the deadline to upgrade, which was last December, DEQ's 8 staff that are involved in this were involved working with people to make these upgrades happen and work with them on how to make them happen. After the deadline, they're working on maintaining the system. There's a big public and a big private investment in these tanks. And at this point, we have about one person per 750 tanks. And their job for the next few years is to finish off the decommissioning and to make sure that this investment stays in place. You will see eventually a fee bill on this one. Each of these tanks is, we're asking for a $60 fee per year on these to support the 8 people that we'd like to keep doing this work. In California and Washington, the number per tank is between $100 and $200, so ours is lower, but we are asking that it be at $60 rather than $35 per tank. If we get it at 60, then we're looking at one inspection every 4 years. If it drops, then it's probably going to be around one inspection every 8 years, which really isn't enough to protect the investment and avoid having the cleanups happen in the future. One other slide on the tanks, just to let you know what people have done with these tanks. And what you're looking at is corrosion protection so they don't rust through, leak protection, and we have better methods than we did in the past to prevent the leak. Fill protection so that if there is a spill, they can be contained, especially around the fill pipe. And overfill detection so that if there is an overfill, we can catch it before it leaks into the soil and into the water. And again, the whole purpose here is to avoid damaging groundwater or leaking into other properties. And one more on safe management. This is actually an example of great safe management. This is from Central Oregon. It's at Kingsley Field. And the hazardous waste program really works to end up with this kind of a situation. The regional offices around the state provide technical assistance, and they also do inspections. This one is, if you just look through what they have here, they have locking lids so that the contaminants or the hazardous waste don't get mixed. They have a lined basin so that if there is a spill, they can capture it. There's clear labeling so that anybody that gets near these knows what they're dealing with. The drums are actually under a roof so you can't see it, so rain doesn't get in these and you don't have spills or overflows. And there's also, you can't really see it well, but in the background there's safety information so that if there is an accident, people know exactly what to do immediately. So again, this is the kind of thing that safe management can end up with, and you don't end up with spills and leaks.
Mr. Chair.
Question on the west one.
Where was that located?
Kingsley Field, near Klamath Falls. And it is, it's a great example of good management. This is a before and after. First, the before. This was an unlined solid waste landfill. It was an open burn spot. Now on the right is what's there now, and this is the same spot. And they had a solid waste grant from DEQ to do planning for this. And they didn't just put the transfer station over top of what you see on the left. They did a, they got that out of there and did a cleanup. Now they have a transfer station in place. This does a couple things. One of them is help keep toxins out of the environment. It might be a long way to groundwater there, but there can still be toxins in those. And this one is in place and operating. And it replaced the open burning uncontrolled disposal site. So, in conclusion, a lot of people think of pollution as only an industrial problem. It's clearly a problem that affects everyone. What I tried to show in my presentation is the impact, the threats to Oregon's environment. I talked about DEQ's role in addressing those threats across the state, and the progress we've made, and also what's left still to do, which is quite a bit. In the spills program, we have a tiny staff, and the number of spills is increasing across the state. Tanks, the regulated tanks, which are the gas station tanks, we are right now at the level of one person per 750 tanks left in the state trying to manage those. The heating oil tanks, there are thousands of those across the state, and at this point, DEQ doesn't have staff. We have stolen staff from other programs in excess of 11,000 calls per year on those heating oil tanks. In hazardous waste, the population growth and the economic growth mean that there are also more hazardous substances in place and being used across the state. We're making good progress across the state in a lot of these environmental programs. You heard from the person from Astoria yesterday about an example of a thread that we've tried to build into all of the waste efforts, and that is the cleanup or the compliance and the inspections and the technical assistance are all important. And to the extent that DEQ can understand and make use of the economics of these and the and recognize the business needs, these cleanups and others work much better, and we can end up with the ground back in production and gas stations back in production. The pictures that I have here, just to close off, the one on the left, on the upper left, is a person fishing, of course. It's an example of what we're trying to protect, a use we're trying to protect. The one on the bottom is a Camas Creek spill, and that's the sort of thing we're trying to guard against. And the street level example is a local mall area in Milwaukee, and those are the kinds of businesses and activities that we deal with every day as we try to deliver environmental protection every day. We do have a long ways to go, and when we get to the packages, when we get to the work sessions, I'll be talking about those. And other than that, I'll stop unless there are questions.
Questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you conclude your testimony, Mary, I'm left with the feeling that this is a monumental and growing job, and I'm wondering, you know, at what point in the state that we've reached a level where we cannot sustain it. I mean, and what is there, you know, without wanting to ask you to do something that's going to reduce the size of the agency that you work for, but what is there that we might be able to do that we can in fact do that, because it seems to me that simple economics will not allow us to expand on forever you know, in this regulation and or enforcement. And I happen to have pretty good feelings about the EQ, Mr. Chairman, that they've been very good, I think, in my district in working with me and cooperating and providing me information. But I am concerned about how we keep up with this. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, it's a great question, and it's one that we look at a lot. And the way there are a couple things I would mention in answer. One is, it looks like an overwhelming problem, and there are days when I couldn't agree more with you. But I think that it's a big problem, but it's not one I would describe as out of control and completely unmanageable. And an example is, if you look at the tank program, in 88, country decided that there was a huge groundwater problem and drinking water problem because of tanks across the nation. And in the decade since then, they gave the tank owners a decade to fix those or upgrade them so they wouldn't leak. And we did that. There are some of them that are left at the tail end that haven't been dealt with, and we will be dealing with those for a while. Along with the upgrades came the requirement to clean those up, of course, and we have another decade before we finish the cleanup. But so long as we maintain that investment that we've all made in the tanks, then and it's not solved, but it's certainly, we have our arms around that part of it. The other answer I would give you is that what you do makes a big difference. And to the extent that we can work our way up the hierarchy somewhat and work on things like technical assistance and work with people like the Astoria example is a great example of, you can get a lot of things done if you understand how the city works or the business works. And then the economics can work for you. When there's a sale, a lot of things can happen to get the cleanup done as well. So, and the other thing is, there aren't big expansion requests that we're making. So we're getting some of the very high priority work done. There's some critical work that I would suggest to you that isn't covered right now, like the spill stuff. We have, the safety net in this state is thin on spills, as we've seen. We had a great example of it. But I wouldn't suggest to you that it's completely unmanageable and out of hand. It just, we need to stay on top of these things and be smart enough to figure out when to push technical assistance instead of enforcement and not spend all of our dollars on enforcement, for instance. So I think those are the kinds of discussions that we've been having with you, and that's the way we should look at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further?
Mr. Chair, covered it all. Mr. Marsh, thanks very much.
For me?
She sounds like she covered it all, Mr. Chair.
For a very good time, too. Mr. Chair, we'd now like to move to respond to one of the issues that we discussed a little bit earlier, and that has to do with the another aspect of safe management that Mary just got finished talking about, and that has to do with the Umatilla Chemical Demilitarization Facility. And we have Wayne Thomas, who is our Umatilla manager for the Hazardous Waste Program, to bring up to date a little bit on the Emergency Preparedness Program, DEQ's role in it, and also the question of how we are going to make the decision about the adequacy of the CSEP program, the Emergency Preparedness Program, before any burning is allowed at the facility.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wayne Thomas. I am the program manager for the Umatilla Chemical Agent Disposal Program. My office is located in Hermiston, Oregon, approximately 8 miles east of the Umatilla Chemical Depot. I do have a packet of handouts that I'd like to make available to the committee. What I'd like to do this morning is give you a brief overview of the construction status of the facility, where we are in regards to the permitting activities, and then talk about emergency response and how the department is going to work with other agencies to allow the governor to make a decision for activities to proceed at the site. The department issued a permit for construction of the facility in February of 1997, and since that time we have transferred our operation from our Bend office to Hermiston and staffed that office up. We have engineers and scientists there who work with NARA very closely. We have a very intensive oversight program of all the activities that are going on at the site. We have an office at the site and inspections on a daily basis. Construction right now is at about 38%, and that number is actually based on dollars that the Army has paid their contractor. Physically on the ground, it appears that they're much closer to completion than that. There's a lot of concrete that's been poured. There's a lot of physical structure to see. They're doing a lot of work right now inside the buildings and so forth. I think Representative Denson has actually visited the site in the past and seen some of the activity going on there. The handout that I just gave you actually focuses on the emergency preparedness aspect of what will go on out there. One of the major concerns that we have, as do all the members of the community out there, is what will happen in the event of the unlikely event of a release of chemical agent occurring at the depot, and what the department will do with the other, in association with other agencies, to address public concerns. The first handle I have is a map showing the location of the site and two zones which surround the chemical depot. The dark shaded area indicates what's called the immediate response zone. And residents that live within that area will receive a shelter-in-place kit and also a tone alert radio which will advise them immediately of an incident occurring at the depot and advise them of what actions to take. The stippled area surrounding that is a protective action zone, and those residents in that area may be required to take some action, but maybe not. The chemical depot, as you can see, is right in the middle of those zones.
I can't see a scale.
Oh. Well, from the depot to Pendleton, which is actually off here, well, Stanfield is about 25 miles or so from the depot. And as you can see, this actually goes into the state of Washington, and you'll see that there are major players in the activities that are going on out there. To address emergency response actions, the Army and FEMA, about 10 years ago, created what's called the Chemical Stockpile Emergency Preparedness Program. And this was designed to enhance emergency preparedness in communities surrounding chemical stockpile facilities. So over the past decade, agencies involved in this program have undertaken different actions to enhance their program to be prepared in case of an agent release.
Question for Ken King.
The Marine Safety Zone, if you had shaded a little different.
Yes, sir.
And in the anecdotal, what the level of the possibility of responding to something is for that, to really catch.
Marine Safety Zone is designed to, in the event, because of the lot of fishing activity and barge activity on the river, in the event that there's a relief that may migrate north and cross the river, the zone is defined so that the local sheriff and Coast Guard who has jurisdiction in that area would evacuate and people on the river either west down to Crow Butte State Park, which is actually off this map, or they would, if they're north of the McNary Dam, they would go east, or northeast, and get off the river. That's the intent of the Marine Safety Zone. Simply that.
Sure evacuation.
Sure evacuation, that's right. I'm on slide 4, which I want to identify who the lead agency is for you in terms of emergency response action. Oregon Emergency Management is the lead agency for coordinating all the emergency response actions for the Umatilla CSEP community. And they have been in that lead role since 1989. The next slide indicates who are the different players involved.
Question Eric initially.
In regards to the OEM being the designated lead, have you
then dry runs and practice runs to see how that process works?
There's an annual exercise in May of each year. In fact, the next one is scheduled for May 12th. And as part of that process, all the players are work together. The way the exercise happens is actually an exercise that's coordinated by FEMA. They actually design the exercise in conjunction with the other members of the EMSL community. And the exercise design has been going on and is still going on for the next one. And then there's a cold start of the exercise the morning of the event, and they work through their plans. And following the exercise, there's an evaluation by FEMA designated evaluators who are at different emergency operations centers to see how the different agencies perform, identify the weaknesses, and lay out corrective measures for future exercises.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
What is the response time? Obviously, then you've done this several years in a row. What is the response time from when you declare an emergency?
Well, let me kind of explain how an emergency is declared, if I can, and it's somewhat outside my area of expertise, if you can, really. At the depot itself, and I'll get into this a little later, when they are moving munitions, or if they detect that there's an agent release, they have, I believe it's 10 minutes, once they confirm that they have an agent release, to notify the surrounding community. And that is done through a crash phone, which is an automatic pick up the phone. It rings at the other end automatically, as well as over email. They also fax a notification. And we also have a computer system now called CMIS, which allows for plotting of the plume, likely plume direction. And Morrow and Umatilla counties and Benton County, Washington, have the same software and can see that display on the computer instantaneously. And that call would go to the 911 operator in each of the counties. And then their function would be to follow the plans that they already have in place, which would be to start a call down of elected officials and first responders and similar type folks. They would activate the sirens and the reader boards to advise the community. It would also activate the phone alert radios, which would provide a message that there's been a release. And that the first response for communities is to shelter in place, and they use their shelter in place kits to do that. And then that allows the county time to make a better informed protective action decision of whether they should evacuate some communities or have them stay in place.
Well, sure. That sounds great for the first response. My concern is this office of OEM in Salem, and at what point are they involved, and who makes the decisions, such as whether the school children should be sent home or whether they should be protected in the school building, those kind of things?
The OEM Emergency Operations Center in Salem is notified at the same time as the county. The decision for whether the school children will stay in their schools, which are over-pressurized. 11 of the schools have been over-pressurized, so that if there's an agent release, they activate a system where they can stay within, I think it's the gymnasium in the school, and basically feel it's a positive pressure situation. Right now, as I understand it, that's a decision that has been made that the children will stay in the schools during the school hours. But that's the decision that's made at the county level by their emergency manager and elected officials.
Just a brief comment, Mr. Chair. When we had our incidents with East Bay with the new Carissa, there was a breakdown there, I guess. And so when the office in Salem was in charge, when DEQ was in charge, who made the health decisions, such as when the kids are taken out of school and those kind of things. So that's my reason for asking the question.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And following a little on Representative Messerly's points, and I think you're right that there is the decision is made that the children stay in school. That to move them would be far more hazardous than to keep them there. The one issue in that relationship to that that I note we have considerable problem with is that the Head Start school in Umatilla has not been pressurized at this point, and that is going to be in almost inevitably in harm's way in the event of an event. I'm curious a little if you're able or if you will be involved in any pressure to, no pun intended, to get that facility pressurized.
We are not involved in those discussions at all. That those discussions would be between Oregon Emergency Management, the counties, and FEMA.
Okay. And if I might look at your following a little on the discussion, and again, it may not be DEQ that that we are concerned with some of these issues, but this issue of emergency preparedness and the Office of Emergency Management is one that concerns me a lot, and I don't have any illustrations related to this, fortunately, now. But we did have two major forest or prairie fires over in Umatilla County not too long ago, and there was a noticeable breakdown with the state's Office of Emergency Management and for one issue being able to get those big helicopters we have with the National Guard in the air to put water on the fires, and at the expense almost of literally having the fire go through and, you know, burn the helicopters, because one of the fires went right through, as you're aware, the airport. It does seem to me, Mr. Chair, that we do have a problem in relationship to this working out these emergency management between the state and the county, and in this case, perhaps the federal government. And I don't know exactly where we go or how we do that, but I would appreciate all of your efforts to try to do more in that area.
I think you're correct in that there needs to be further assessment of that. I know that the fires that occurred this summer in the Pendleton area great cause for concern, simply because of the capacity of the phone system to handle all the calls. Everybody called 911, and it blew the system. So we anticipate or considering, well, what happens if there's an agent release? Everybody's going to call 911. It's hard to educate people not to do that when that's what they've been taught to do over the years when there's an incident.
Just one additional footnote on this. I think to get the helicopters in the air required the governor, and we couldn't get a hold of the governor.
Mm-hmm. Well, we soon have a lieutenant governor.
If I could move on to the slide entitled, What is our PSAP role for DEQ?
Let's show one more question for me.
Senator Turner, ask a question.
On the partnership for CSVCC, it seemed to me that it was done on a mission as far as police and fire is concerned, because you're always going to have police responders to the scene of a disaster. And not only one thing goes after, but you're going to have law enforcement and fire response. And I don't see that anywhere in the schematic.
That's correct, sir. Mr. Chairman, the first responder community, the local fire district, and sheriff and city police and so forth, are captured under the county label. And the purpose of that, or the reason for that, is that the counties are the jurisdictions that have primary responsibility for emergencies within their county. So that's where they're captured. So for DEQ, let me explain what our role is. In the event of a release, which we all hope never happens, of course, our role would be to provide considerable technical assistance and guidance to the first responder community as they're dealing with monitoring activity, contamination, and questions from the public that would come in, or can I drink my water? Can I go outside? All those types of questions. We will be at the Emergency Operations Center there to assist the county, other agencies, with all of those questions that come in. When you have a release of agents, there's two different phases. There's the immediate release and the response, the emergency response. But as time goes on, you move into what's called the recovery phase. It's not an emergency anymore, but you still can't go back into the area. You have to recover, restore that area back to its original condition. DEQ would be the lead agency for environmental restoration and cleanup work in conjunction with other agencies, of course, because this would be a team effort in restoring the community back to its original condition. And the third role that we have relates to a permit condition, which was put in at the Body Environmental Quality Commission. And that says that a certification from the governor is required that an adequate emergency response program is in place and fully operational for protecting the general population prior to thermal operations beginning at the plant. Well, that permit condition really begs a lot of questions. We have to define what adequate means, and we have to come up with a process to make an assessment of, is it adequate, therefore can the governor make the decision to proceed? DEQ and Oregon Emergency Management got together about a year ago and recognized that we had an issue that we had to resolve. And we have been working with a contractor and all the folks listed in that hematologist community with to define the process by where we can do exactly that. Agree as to what is adequate for the community and define a process that will allow the governor to make a decision. We've broken it down into different levels of review. All of the members of the community that I've itemized will do the work, will do their own assessment of if they're ready, using 17 criteria that are FEMA standards, as well as some other ones that we've come up specific to our local community. We've also defined what we've called an executive review panel, which consists of several agency heads, head of DEQ, OEM, health division, as well as elected officials, the chair of the Citizens Advisory Commission, a representative from the state of Washington, governor's office. And that executive panel will actually review the work that's done by the community and make a decision to either advise the governor that, yes, we can proceed, or, no, we're not ready, the community needs to do more, here's the direction you need to go in. So that's the process that we kind of have in place right now. The point that we're at is that we are meeting with, on Friday, the local elected officials at the county level to advise them of this process and tell them what their input is and what we're doing. So this is a bottom-up self-assessment of if we're ready as a community to do this, or if we're not ready, we can't proceed. That's the process that we have in place right now. We're just putting it together. The next slide I have is what happens if there's a chemical agent released, and we kind of talked about that a little bit already. At the depot, they have different types of releases that may occur. They have a release that will just stay on post. They have a release that they will project or go off post into the community. They have a release that may just stay within an igloo. Different levels of release. But to the community, it's irrelevant. We want to know any time there's an agent release. That's a big deal. So anytime there's a release, the community is notified. The action that's taken by the community is dependent on if the release is only in an igloo, you don't need to do anything because it's contained or what have you. In the event that it's a release that goes is projected to go off-site by the computer simulation that they use, the depot will make the hotline call to the community, and the process will be initiated. And I've tried to itemize in the following slide what each of the counties will do. For example, Umatilla County, they will receive the notification, dispatchers will notify the fire departments, law enforcement, other first responders and county officials. The call down will start. People will be activated. Emergency operations centers still active. The dispatcher sound the sirens. Activate the highway reader boards on Interstate 84.
Okay, Marshall, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you mentioned earlier that they are responsible for notifying within 10 minutes when they're aware of the incidents. I've traveled through that area several times over the years, and I know how hard that wind can blow. Is there a tremendous exposure? I don't know how you can, I don't know how automatic some of these notifications are, but 10 minutes seems like quite a lot of time in certain situations, and yet when I look at all the people that have to be notified, and I'm, you know, how fast, I'm wondering if there's not a problem here.
A lot of these things are simultaneous. The fence basically hit a button, and the sirens go off, the reader boards go off, it's all instantaneous. The call down happens automatically. There's nobody sitting there dialing down the list. These things are happening simultaneously once that crash call happens. Let me back up a little bit to the 10-minute issue. Prior to the initiation of operations at the depot every day, they run a computer model using the FEMA system. If the weather conditions are that it is, there's a potential that a release would go off site, if one occurred, they can operate. So that provision is already in place. So I think that adds to reducing the likelihood of a release occurring, which would go off site as well. But on the surface, the 10 minutes does appear to be a long time. But a lot of these activities are happening instantaneously and simultaneously. So,
that's 10 minutes maximum, probably. Maybe that's from the time someone is aware of it. What kind of a system do you have in place if there's not personnel present, or what is the potential for problem or an incident that you wouldn't know about for some time?
At the depot itself, the emergency operations center they were required by the DEQ permit to have that operational 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and it reached that mode, I believe 90 days after the permit was issued, and we also required that facility be overpressurized, and it reached that status in December of 1998. So they have a constant presence at the depot monitoring what's happening. When the munitions are within the igloos and not being used, if there is a release, it will be contained within the igloos anyway. It's only when they're actually moving them that there's the potential for a release if a bomb explodes or a rocket breaks or something, where the potential then exists for it to migrate off-site. So it's only during an active operation. If I could add one more piece to that. When the incinerator plant goes online and they actually begin to move the munitions from the storage facilities to the plant, they will be placed within what we call on-site containers, which are leak-proof, explosion-proof. So once they go into those containers, they're secured anyway. And any leakage within that will be contained.
Okay, sir.
How much are we at the mercy of U.S. West from this?
That's okay. I don't think I can answer that, but I would say that's an issue that is routinely discussed at our meetings.
Okay.
Question, Senator Sherman.
Are these outlines DEQs or are they oil and gas?
This is, I put this together yesterday very quickly.
I mean, yeah, it's not a simple language. Yeah, legally here, your EOT is actually the first.
And that, because that brings in your fire chief, your law enforcement administrators, and other individuals who are involved in the operation of the transfers from the bottom of the world.
Oh, that's an incorrect presentation on my part. Correct.
questions?
If I could conclude this aspect of the presentation, I'll step down, so I think I'm taking up a lot of your time here.
Well, I think we're investing our time here. Okay.
As I said earlier, we're in the process of doing this internal or self-assessment of where are we with our program. We could certainly respond today. The counties and the state can respond to an incident today. Are we at a level where we think we have an adequate level of response? I think the answer to that would be no. Some of the equipment that the counties have, they haven't been trained on yet, and they need that active training program to do an effective job. In the past couple of years, there's been a significant enhancement in the equipment that's available and the plans that are in place. One major aspect that we do not have yet are the tone alert radios for the community. And that, from some simulations that we've done with our contractor, is the single item that will improve our response notification to the community, having these phone alert radios in place.
Okay,
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I understand the radios are not in place at the present time. The other thing, though, that concerns me with that, and I'll really go with it, is that many of the people who would potentially be in harm's way are non-English speaking, transitory, which it's going to take almost an infinite supply of radios to make sure every time they come into the community that they have a radio and a training process it's a monumental problem. I think here, which tends to get kind of glossed over under the terminology that we've got these tone alert radios that once they're out there, everybody will know what's going on. And I understand that this is not necessarily DEQ's area of jurisdiction, but it's certainly something I'd like everybody to be aware of.
I'll give a point. I think you're correct. It's simply saying give them tone alert radios and they'll be okay is not appropriate. There is a significant education public awareness program that needs to be in place as part of that distribution when those radios become available. And, you know, we talked about having, hazardous waste days where people bring their things out of their basement. We're going to have tone alert radio days when radios that don't work anymore get turned in and they get new ones, because that's going to happen. And there's different aspects to this that are not in place yet. But I agree. I think that's where we are with the CSEP program and our kind of status of being able to respond to an incident. We can respond today. We can be better as time goes on because we're getting, the community, I'm thinking of the community, is getting more equipment, we're getting better educated, and the plans are in place, and I think things are coming along better.
Question up for next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you put this in perspective for us? I'm thinking of what are the chances of you could have an incident. I'm thinking like 2 years ago they had a dynamite truck blow up in Roseburg. I mean, what's the chances of that ever happening? You could have a gas tanker catch on fire in the middle of some city and create all kinds of havoc. But not that any life is expendable. That's not my point at all. But what, I'm sure you folks have worked this through many times, but just how much risk is there involved here?
The Army did what's called a quantitative risk assessment, where they looked at a range of likely events, from an airplane crashing into an igloo, earthquake, rockets exploding. There's a whole report on the different scenarios that are the potential scenarios. The likelihood of it happening is that it's extremely unlikely that this would ever happen. but there is a potential that it could happen. And with that being the case, we need to be prepared in case it does happen, because the consequences of it happening are disastrous for everybody in that community. So we have to be prepared. But the likelihood of it happening is that it is extremely unlikely that anything like this would happen. As I mentioned earlier, they have procedures in place to limit operations when weather conditions are not appropriate. Through our permit, we had a definition with them of severe limitations of operations during severe weather. You know, if the winds exceed such and such, or they cannot operate different weather conditions. Once the plant goes online and the munitions are placed in the on-site containers, they're under engineering control. They go into the munitions demilitarization process, which is an explosion-proof system that's under engineering control with environmental controls on it. Everything will be okay. But while the continued storage of these munitions is there, is there a risk? Yes, there is a risk. But the risk is extremely unlikely. And with that in mind, that was DEQ and the Commission's reason for issuing the permit to proceed with the construction of the incinerator, so we can eliminate this risk as soon as possible to the community.
Thank you,
gentlemen.
Thank you. This is kind of a damned if you do and damned if you don't sort of thing. As you say, as long as the munitions are there, the risk is always there. And in fact, with one exception, that is the actual transport from the igloo to the truck that takes the material to the incinerator, the risks are there whether we incinerate or whether we do not. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, if I may respond to Representative Jensen, that was the thing that impressed the Commission, I think, the most, was that actually the greatest, while the risk was very small, as Wayne has said, the greatest risk was not from the operation of the facility, according to the risk assessment. It was from earthquakes and airplane crashes and things that could happen, whether or not there was anything done about the demilitarization and incineration. And so the Commission's thinking, although there was a promise of you know, maybe an even safer technology than incineration sometime down the road, the weighing the risks, they believe that the best thing to do was to get rid of the emissions as quickly as possible, and incineration was the available technology. And that the risks of accidents during the incineration process were not the greatest risk to the community. It was these other things over which there was no control.
Just one concluding on that, and one of those risks is simply spontaneous explosion in an igloo. And that happens, if I understand correctly, to be something we really, all we know is they're very volatile materials and they are deteriorating, and we don't really know whether they become a high-risk item next year or 100 years from now. Is that reasonably accurate?
I think that's reasonably accurate. I would characterize it as they've gone past their shelf life. And the manufacturer has indicated that you cannot use these. In fact, there are no, for the rockets, I think that's what we're talking about here, not the conventional bombs. The rockets, there are no existing launchers even available to use the rockets. There's one in a museum in Alabama somewhere. That's about it. So we have over 100,000 of these rockets that we have to get rid of. And they have gone past their shelf life, and there are certainly issues of the agent reaction to the aluminum casing that they're within, and degradation of that. So the sooner we can take care of those, the better.
The chemical agents that are stored at the depot,
Are they inventory?
Yes.
Is any of the information about the inventory classified information?
It previously was, but not any longer. It's available. We have it. In fact, it's in the package of information that we presented you.
How would we know if any of the information is classified?
I can tell you that back in 1992, when the Army declared the stockpile, at that time, it was known that there were chemical agents at the depot, but what was there was unknown. That was classified. And it was through the federal government becoming, or signing the Chemical Weapons Convention, and working through that process, that the declaration of the stockpile nationwide occurred. So, I don't know if we, I mean, it's kind of hard, I can't answer your question. I don't know if they have other materials that are classified. One of the things that we will be doing, I can tell you, at the depot, they have 999 igloos there. And as part of the closure, we will be inspecting every one of those to see what's in there.
Is there any biological agent there?
Okay.
That we know of.
That we know of, yes.
Do we have information on the effective range of the chemical agent in terms of the kill zone?
The Army has done considerable studies on the effective range of the agents. We have three types of agents in the cellar. There's a GB agent, which is the agent that was used in the Tokyo subway example a couple of years ago. We have DX, and then we have HD, which is a mustard agent. The first two are nerve agents. The mustard agent is a blister agent, which acts very differently than the nerve agent. The effective range of the agents is in large part based on weather conditions and the dispersion of the agents and the concentration of the agents, and how much is released. But the toxicity of the agent, the Army has done a considerable study on how much, well, what the no-effect dose of the agent is. So we do have that information.
How far is Unitella from the depot?
It's approximately, actually the closest community is Aragon, which is about a mile and a half north of the northern fence. And Umatilla is maybe 3 miles, maybe a little bit northeast of that. And then Hermiston is approximately 8 miles from the, in the easterly direction, from the eastern boundary.
And the early warning system is set up so that it has to be activated within 10 minutes of the release.
At the latest.
With a southwest wind blowing at 6 miles an hour, possible that at least two of the communities would experience contamination before the early warning requirement kicks in.
As I indicated earlier, what the Army will do before they begin operations to move agents, munitions from the igloo into containers and open the igloo, they run a simulation that, based on existing weather conditions, if there's a potential that there would be an agent release that would migrate off post, they would not operate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's probably in my book if I wanted to dig through and find it, but it's easier to ask. Is any of this funded by general fund, or is this all paid for through the Army? Your DEQ's finances and whole thing?
It's funded by the Army.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, we will be presenting a package that continues and expands Wayne's operation, but it is entirely federally funded as the Army.
I guess the other question is between the first and second warning. There's a 10-minute first warning and a 15-minute second warning. And I guess I'd like to see what the, you know, what potential contaminant spread in 25 minutes it looked like. Probably not a very pretty diagram to look at. Are there simulations like that?
There are. Let me, you can take different scenarios of having one rocket explode during transport, which will subsequently ignite a crate of other rockets. And 20 minutes later, another rocket will go off and so forth. And you can, you know, create whatever scenario you want using the computer simulation. Using the system, you can project that plume and where it will go. The only downfall it's a conservatism built into the simulation, is that it assumes a flat land surface with no obstructions. So it projects the plume, you know, straight through hills and so forth, which is a problem because, you know, with some of the gullies we have out there, it could not do that. So to account for that, the Army puts in their simulation a protective action wedge around that, 60 degrees either side of the plume, so that we know the plume's here, but, you know, we're going to say anybody who's within this wedge could potentially be affected by the plume. Okay, so they run different simulations. Depending on what the wind condition is and what the agent is, because the nerve agent is the two different kinds of those act differently because they have different properties. Actually, a slower wind will allow a higher concentration of agent to get off property. A higher wind will disperse it quicker, but may not get there. You think if you have, you know, 50 mile an hour wind and end up in Asia, well, it'll get off site. Well, that's true, but it's going to be dispersed very quickly. So it may not get there at all. So a lower wind velocity is a bigger issue, potentially for agent getting off site. So hundreds of simulations have been run to look at these different scenarios. And like I said, every day the Army will run a simulation to see what's happening. Now, in the event of a release or during an exercise, the Army will plot this off. It's simultaneously seen by the county, and they can see what's happening. What they do is, based on the data that is presented to them over the CNIS system, the county officials will make a protective action decision that, okay, the plume appears to be going towards Umatilla. We're not going to evacuate the folks in Umatilla. They'll shelter in place. If we evacuate them, they may come out into the atmosphere and be exposed to agents. We'll keep them in place. Whereas people in Aragon, maybe they'll head west on 730 and get out of the way. So the 10 minutes to the 15 minutes allows a decision to be made.
I guess I see that as a theoretical threshold, assuming things go as planned. I guess the history of notification programs takes me back to October 12, 1962, when we had the Civil Defense Early Warning System, and that was supposed to function to warn people about weather, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the state storms surprised everybody about the inefficiency of our system, and there's been probably dozens of other plans made and remade in the decades since 1962. The other issue for me is that I understand it's extremely unlikely that lightning will strike any individual in this room, but 40 fatalities a year are reported. And I think it's probable that there will be an ammunition dump exploding in an ammunition dump. You've got the statistics would probably back you, well, the probability and the statistics would back the idea that it's extremely unlikely there will be an accidental discharge. But I don't think it's extremely unlikely that there'll be an accidental explosion in an ammunition dump. It seems to me not an if question, but a when question.
I can't tell you that at Umatilla. The site actually started operation in October 1941. They have only had one explosion the whole time. And that occurred at I think 1944 or something like that, and they had five deaths at that time, five or six deaths. That's the only time they've had an explosion.
That's a high, heck of a lot higher statistical probability than getting hit by lightning.
Mr. I'm confused. You said that under certain wind conditions that you closed down the operation, and then I heard you say that you're safer in a high wind than you are in a low wind. So when do you close, when, what type of condition would you close down if still?
Well, when you say facility, I'm not sure, you mean the depot or, okay. And we can say that we're going to have two facilities there. There's the chemical depot itself, which is a storage location, and the treatment facility, which would be the incinerator project. On a daily basis, as I indicated, they do a simulation to see if agent will migrate off-site. I did say that under lower wind velocities, it's more likely that if there is a release, it would get off-site. Not that it would get off-site, but that it would get off-site at a concentration that would be potentially toxic to the community. Doesn't increase the likelihood that it'll get off site, but if it did get off site, it would be at a toxic concentration.
So the question is, what is your ideal condition? Is the wind blowing or not blowing?
I think the ideal condition is a day that where the wind is not blowing or not blowing strongly. And it's good for workers to work, where they can move the munitions safely from the igloos to the containers to get them to the treatment plant. We want to be sure that their work environment is such that they're not going to slip and drop something or not follow procedure because they're not comfortable in their work environment, and they're able to follow their procedures, which are very well defined. I think that is the optimum work conditions that we want. If those workers are comfortable and know their procedures and can work effectively, that will allow those munitions to be transferred from the storage bunkers to the on-site containers without any incident. And then once they're in those containers, they're okay. We know we're under control at that point. So I think that's the optimum condition that we want.
Further?
You said there are 900 and some odd igloos. That's not in Cape Hawk, though.
Oh, no. No, that's the entire property.
Yeah. And the only igloos that have any ordnance are in Cape Hawk.
That's correct. Okay. Yeah. And all of the igloos that you see from Interstate 84 and 82 are empty. There's no munitions. Only K block, and J block is used for the storage of waste that they generate from the maintenance activities, and will also be used for storage of waste generated from the treatment of the chemical agents in the plant, and then they'll process those back to the plant.
And one other item on K block, security is different on K block than on the rest of the depot.
Yes, it is. Yes, they have guard towers with heavily armed security guards, and it's a separate security check to go in there. You have to have a mask and be checked out on that to get in there. There's much difference. If ever you're driving by at night, you can actually see it out there because it's a lighted area in the middle of the property.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I was impressed by the shoot on site signage that accompanies all of that security.
Well, I'm sure the committee will be very interested in reviewing the budget chapters. Thank you for the presentation.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Hearing none, let's move forward.
We continue. Today.
We have a session, floor session at 10:30 today for both chambers, so if there's any concluding remarks, let's get to those and then address for that.
Do you have anything that's performing?
Okay. Well, our next presentation, Mr. Chair, was going to be water quality with Mike Llewellyn. If you want us to start that for a few minutes, we can, but otherwise we can start tomorrow morning.
I think it would be the hour and the session starting. We'll go ahead and adjourn for the day. We have a couple of other members of the body that wish to be here for the water quality discussion. We may have some visiting celebrities from other committees tomorrow. Thanking in brisk fashion to the rest of the pleasure room. We got the last couple of days involved in engaged in the standard questions, not financial, but that's fine. Any other questions you can come to before we adjourn? We are adjourned.